Hello, and welcome to this week's reading of The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media, all you need to know about everything that matters. I'm reading from the April 19th issue. First, we turn to The World at a Glance. From Beijing, warning to Taiwan. Taiwan's reunification with China is inevitable, Chinese President Xi Jinping said this week, but could come through peaceful annexation rather than war. Xi made the statement, a pointed message to Taiwan's incoming president, Lai Ching-te, who supports Taiwan's de facto independence during a highly unusual visit from Taiwan's former pro-Beijing leader, Ma Ying-jeou. This is the first time a former Taiwanese leader has been hosted by China's top leader since Chinese nationalists fled to Taiwan in 1949. China-Taiwan relations thawed during Ma's 2008 through 2016 tenure, but since then, Taiwan has been governed by pro-autonomy forces, and China has repeatedly menaced its shores with warships. By meeting with Ma, analyst Amanda Hsiao told CNN.com she was showing he will negotiate only with those, quote, who accept the idea that the two sides of the strait belong to one China, end quote. From Grozny, Russia, Western music banned. Authorities in the Russian Republic of Chechnya have banned all music that is either too fast or too slow. Chechen Culture Minister Musa Dadayev said last week that all musical, vocal, and choreographic compositions must have a tempo between 80 and 116 beats per minute, in keeping with Chechen musical tradition. The directive, part of a government campaign to suppress Western influences in the conservative, mostly Muslim region of 1.4 million people, effectively outlaws most pop, including global mega-hits like Taylor Swift's upbeat Shake It Off, 160 beats per minute, and Drake's meandering God's Plan, 77 beats per minute. Borrowing musical culture from other people is inadmissible, Dadayev said. Local musicians have until June 1st to rewrite any offending tunes. From Kigali, Rwanda, the world sat by. Rwandan President Paul Kagame this week blamed the international community for not intervening to prevent the 1994 Rwandan genocide, when ethnic Hutu extremists slaughtered minority Tutsis, killing 800,000 people in 3 months. The 30th anniversary remembrance ceremonies were attended by dozens of foreign dignitaries, including Bill Clinton, who was U.S. president at the time and has since expressed regret for not responding quickly enough. At the ceremony, Kagame said the international community, quote, failed us all, whether from contempt or cowardice, end quote. Afterward, he criticized the current U.S. administration as well. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's message had mourned the many thousands of Tutsis, Hutus, Twas, and others whose lives were lost, and Kagame said it was a failure to acknowledge that the genocide victims were overwhelmingly Tutsi. Moving to Strasbourg, France, climate as human rights issue. The European Court of Human Rights ruled this week that Switzerland's failure to cut greenhouse gases had violated its citizens' rights, a landmark decision that could open the door to litigation across the European Union. The plaintiffs, 2,000 Swiss women, mostly in their 70s, argued their government had endangered the last decades of their lives by not doing enough to fight climate change, because elderly women are most at risk of heat-related deaths. It's the first time an international court has made a ruling on the obligations of a government in the face of climate crisis. This is only the beginning, said Swedish activist Greta Thunberg outside the court. More and more people are taking their governments to court to hold them accountable. From the Vatican City, opposed to sex reassignment. The Vatican released Catholic guidance this week calling, quote, any sex change intervention and gender theory, end quote, threats to human dignity. Infinite dignity says that every person, regardless of sexual orientation, has inherent worth, but adds that altering one's God-given sex is an attempt to make oneself God. The highly anticipated 23-page document also denounces poverty and war as threats to human dignity, as well as abortion, surrogacy, and euthanasia. Pope Francis has come under criticism from conservative Catholics recently for affirming that transgender people can be baptized and serve as godparents, and for approving the blessing of same-sex couples. The Church is still stuttering on these topics, gay Catholic activist Ignacio Pontillo told the Washington Post. The Pope's pastoral approach leads to reception, but then you read stuff like this. From Managua, Nicaragua, suing Germany over Israel. Nicaraguans argued this week before the International Court of Justice in The Hague that Germany is enabling genocide in Gaza by selling weapons to Israel. Germany should know there is serious risk of genocide, said Nicaraguan diplomat Carlos José Arguello Gómez, because the ICF said as much earlier this year in a preliminary ruling in a South African case against Israel. He argued that it didn't matter whether German weapons were actually being used to shell hospitals or simply going to replenish Israeli stockpiles, because the assurance of supplies and replacement of armaments is crucial to Israel's pursuit of the attacks in Gaza. Germany is Israel's second largest weapons supplier and sees support for the Jewish state as its moral duty after the Holocaust. Israel's top military supplier, the U.S., is harder to sue because it's not an ICJ member. And finally, from Brasilia, Musk won't ban trolls. The Brazilian Supreme Court will investigate Elon Musk for obstruction of justice after he reactivated far-right accounts on X that the court had flagged for removal. The court announced the probe this week following Musk's comment the Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes should resign or be impeached for ordering social media sites to suspend accounts that distribute hate speech or misinformation. The flagged X accounts are thought to be part of the court's investigation into far-right disinformation launched after election-denying supporters of Brazilian ex-president Jair Bolsonaro stormed Brazil's capital on January 8th of 2023. It's not about Twitter or Brazil, digital media researcher Nina Santos and the Brazilian National Institute of Science and Technology told Wired. It's about a strategy from the global far right to overcome democracies and democratic institutions around the world. Next, we'll move to some sample editorials. First, turmoil in Arizona over revived 1864 abortion ban. What happened? Arizona Supreme Court this week upheld a 160-year-old abortion ban threatening to upend the swing state's presidential and Senate races. In a 4-2 decision, the court ruled that without a federal right to abortion, the 1864 law could be enforced. It forbids abortion from the moment of conception, with an exception for life-threatening emergencies. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, state lawmakers on both sides of the issue sought to clarify whether the Civil War-era ban superseded a 15-week ban enacted in 2022. A lower court ruled that it did not, but the higher court disagreed. The ruling was placed on hold for 14 days, will go into effect after a 45-day wait. Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes said no one would be prosecuted under the, quote, draconian law, end quote. Republican Senate candidate Kerry Lake, who once backed the 1864 law, called it out of step with Arizonans. but Republicans in the state legislature blocked an effort to repeal it. The Arizona ruling came just a day after Trump tried to defang abortion as an election issue by saying he would leave abortion policy up to the states. "We've taken the abortion issue largely out of play," he wrote on social media. But following the Arizona decision, Trump said the ban went too far, predicting the state's Democratic governor would bring it back into reason. Trump's statement angered many of his allies on the religious right. "This seeds the national debate to the Democrats," said Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America President Marjorie Dannenfelser. What the columnist said. "Arizona is a quote-unquote warning," said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. Its court resurrected a zombie ban, and national anti-abortion activists hoped to do the same with the 1873 Comstock Act, which outlawed transporting drugs or supplies used for abortions. Arizonans will vote on a constitutional amendment guaranteeing abortion rights in November, so this ruling could be short-lived, but the rights efforts to return to the Victorian age could be every state's future if Trump wins. So much for taking the issue of abortion out of play for the 2024 election, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. With its ruling, Arizona's high court managed to disprove Trump's claim and blow up his plans. Trump has tried to, quote-unquote, finesse his abortion stand because any national ban is broadly unpopular. But if Arizona is any sign of what unfolds when abortion is left to the states, his efforts at damage control look very fragile. "Trump's stance is designed to look almost moderate," said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times, "but his position is a strikingly conservative departure from mainstream thinking. Almost two-thirds of Americans support legal abortion in most cases. He knows Republicans are dangerously vulnerable on abortion and wants to neutralize the issue." But this is the man who gave the Supreme Court the majority that overturned Roe. If he's reelected, his allies will do everything in their power to ban abortion nationwide. Also from sample editorials, knives out for Speaker Johnson over Ukraine funding. What happened? House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, faced an increasingly noisy hardline threat to his position this week as obstacles to passing funding for aid to Ukraine multiplied. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, accused Johnson of, quote, "a complete and total surrender," end quote, to Democrats, writing in a fiery five-page letter to colleagues that the speaker is publicly saying funding Ukraine is now his top priority when less than 7 months ago he was against it. "Americans," she said, "believe our border is the only border worth fighting a war over." Green could at any time force a vote on her March 22nd motion to oust Johnson from the speakership, lodged after he supported a $1.2 trillion government funding package. In another blow to Johnson's standing, Republicans this week defeated his third attempt to reauthorize the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which allows warrantless wiretaps on U.S. soil. A $95 billion bipartisan Senate aid package passed in February includes $60 billion for Ukraine and $14 billion for Israel, and House members could force it to a vote via discharge petition if they get enough signatures. In the wake of Israel's recent strike on a Gaza aid convoy, though, some Democrats now want the aid to Israel stripped out. Johnson, meanwhile, has been preparing his own Ukraine package that would structure some funding as a loan, requiring the Biden administration to seize and sell off Russian assets to compensate, and attach a mandate to reverse Biden's pause on liquefied natural gas exports. Democrats called the last provision a non-starter. What the columnist said. Johnson faces a very stark choice. Jake Sherman in Punchbowl News, pass a Ukraine aid bill or remain Speaker. Green's threats should be viewed quite seriously, since the party's two-seat House majority will fall to one next week when Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin, retires. It wouldn't take many votes to boot Johnson. Some Republicans say they'll support Ukraine funding if paired with the strict border security measures they passed last May. But since that bill is a no-go with Democrats, those Republicans are by definition opposed to Ukraine funding. Our next segment from The Week magazine, Best Columns. First, How They See Us. Israel bristles at U.S. ultimatum. After months of increasing hostility and festering points of contention, U.S.-Israel relationship is in peril, said Lazar Berman in the Times of Israel. The crisis came last week when Israel Defense Forces bombed a World Central Kitchen convoy in Gaza, killing 7 aid workers, including a U.S. citizen. In a tense 30-minute phone call, President Biden warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel must take, quote, concrete and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers, end quote, in Gaza, or face a change in U.S. policy. Visibly angered, he ordered Netanyahu to pursue an immediate ceasefire. It was quite a turnaround from the president's unconditional support of Israel's right to defend itself after Hamas attackers killed 1,200 people and abducted over 200 more in Israel on October 7th. And it seemed almost personal. Rather than risk appearing anti-Israel, the Biden administration has instead taken aim at Netanyahu, trying to portray the prime minister as unrepresentative of the Israelis at large. It won't work, said Attar Barat in YNetNews.com. Israelis are indeed sick of Netanyahu and his extreme-right government, but they overwhelmingly support the war in Gaza, and they resent political interference by patronizing Americans. When Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called recently for Israelis to push out Netanyahu in an early election, even the prime minister's most bitter opponents denounced Schumer instead. Schumer and Biden act like beloved uncles from America sent to save Israel from itself. But such paternalism doesn't weaken Netanyahu. It merely strengthens the narrative that he's the defender of Israel and the guardian of its interests. What's particularly worrying, said Yair Altman in Now 14, is that Biden seems to be more concerned about Palestinian suffering and the political price he is paying for that than a victory over Hamas. Biden's ultimatum gives Hamas a free pass. Knowing the U.S. president insists on a ceasefire now, Hamas will only harden its positions, insisting that Israel remove all troops and empty its prisons of terrorists, including those who a short time ago murdered and raped our people. Israel cannot agree to that. If Hamas remains entrenched in Gaza, able to plan the next massacre, that will be bad for Palestinians as well as for us. Yet Netanyahu can't simply ignore the superpower that arms us, said Orly Azoulay in Yerioth Aharonoth. Israel could not have asked for a better friend in its hour of need than Joe Biden. But 6 months into the war, with an election looming and U.S. public opinion on the side of the suffering Palestinian civilians, the president needs the war finished. Biden has offered an agreement that would see Saudi Arabia open relations with Israel in exchange for a framework for a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Had Netanyahu accepted the offer and ended the bloodshed, it could have been his greatest hour. Instead, he's announced that he's set a date to invade Rafah, the final remaining Hamas stronghold, where a million civilians are sheltering. Netanyahu is playing with fire, and Israel is the one who might get burned. A best column from India. endorsements from Beyond the Grave, an editorial from the Indian Express. The dead are campaigning in India's upcoming election, said the Indian Express. Political parties of all stripes have been deploying as their star campaigners AI-generated deepfakes of politicians who passed away long ago. Beloved late Tamil leader M. Karunanidhi, for example, appeared as video in a January meeting of his DMK party, extolling the work of his son, M.K. Stalin, as Tamil Nadu's chief minister. Was high praise from an icon who held the job himself for nearly two decades, except that Karunanidhi died in 2018 and never witnessed his son's tenure. Another deceased stalwart from Tamil Nadu, actress-turned-politician J. Jayalalitha, who died in 2016, was resurrected in a February voice message backing her party's candidate for parliament. These deepfakes are good, almost indistinguishable from the genuine article, yet the problem isn't simply that voters could be fooled, it's that we see a need to appeal to past heroes at all. The passing of an older generation is supposed to allow new leadership to emerge and find its own vocabulary and practice. When modern Pauls ride the coattails of the dead to suggest a troubling failure of imagination, let the leaders of yore rest in peace. They should inspire, not perspire. From Senegal, Two Wives Make Protocol a Problem, by Damien Glaize, from Jeannun Afrique, France, Pan-African. When the president has two wives, who's the first lady? Asked Damien Glaize. The question doesn't seem to concern Senegal's polygamous new leader, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who was sworn in last week with both spouses at his side. On the campaign trail, the 44-year-old former political prisoner made a point of publicly introducing both women. He married Marie, 34, 15 years ago, and Absa, 31, just last year. In mostly Muslim Senegal, where one-third of marriages are polygamous, Faye's thrupledom is less shocking than his election win just weeks after being freed from jail. Still, he is the country's first openly polygamous leader, and certain protocol practices will need tweaking to reflect the new configuration of the Senegalese presidential family. After all, Faye can hardly bring two plus ones to a White House state dinner. How have other African countries handled this dilemma? Niger, in 2011, didn't make its president choose which of two wives should be the first lady, but Gambia, in 2017, did. South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, was four wives at once. Had them take turns attending functions, but occasionally more than one showed up and things grew awkward. Only in symphony orchestras can there be several first violins. And a best column from France, Mini Macron Makes Himself the Star, by Cyprien Cario, La Humanité. The Prime Minister is thrusting himself forward in the most unseemly and un-French ways, as Cyprien Cario, Gabriel Attal, desperate to be anointed successor to term-limited President Emmanuel Macron, has replaced the usual weekly Q&A between lawmakers and cabinet ministers with a one-man show starring himself, modeled on Britain's Prime Minister's Question Time. Who needs a cabinet, the thinking goes, when the prime minister can pose as an expert in everything, capable of tackling the entire opposition single-handedly. As expected, Attal treated the occasion as a pure exercise in showmanship to the detriment of substance and parliamentary dialogue. He batted away every legitimate question with a self-satisfied regurgitation of government talking points. was the behavior of a government spokesperson, his previous occupation, not a prime minister who must be responsible to Parliament. Lawmakers derided the event as propaganda, waste of their time in the service of one man's ego. It could not be otherwise. The ambitious Attal, who was promoted from education minister to prime minister in January at age 34, has his eye on the 2027 presidential election. He seems to believe that to win, he must play mini Macron, pursuing a strategy of hyperactivity and media omnipresence. It's going to be a long few years. The next segment of the Week magazine, Health and Science. Growing a liver from a lymph node. In a groundbreaking experiment, scientists are attempting to grow a new liver inside a patient with liver failure. Procedure developed by Pittsburgh-based biotech company Lygenesis involves the injection of liver cells called hepatocytes into a patient's abdominal lymph nodes. The liver is the only organ capable of rebuilding itself, and in previous experiments in pigs, introducing donor cells allowed animals with damaged organs to develop mini livers with networks of blood vessels and bile ducts that exhibited at least some vital functions. For the first human trial, begun last month, doctors threaded a small tube with a camera down patient's throat into the digestive tract, then used ultrasound to identify the targeted lymph nodes and inject them with 50 million hepatocytes. We're using the lymph node as a living bioreactor, Lygenesis CEO Michael Hufford tells Wired. The mini liver isn't expected to take over all the functions of an original liver, and the recipients could have to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives. Still, if the procedure works, it could be life-saving for many patients. The U.S. liver transplant list is around 10,000 patients long, and 12% of those waitlisted die each year. The new treatment would use donated livers that couldn't be matched with a compatible patient, since the procedure only uses a small amount of material. Up to 75 people could be treated with each donor organ. Also from the Health and Science section, leaky landfills fuel warming. Open landfills are belching out far more methane than the operators report to regulators, a new study shows. That's a problem because the greenhouse gas is a big driver of climate change, with a warming effect more than 80 times that of carbon dioxide over 20 years. The organic waste in landfill, much of it food scraps, emits the methane when it decomposes without oxygen beneath layers of long-buried detritus. Most sites have pipes or wells that collect the methane so that it can be burnt off or used to generate heat and electricity, but these often leak. While the EPA requires facilities to measure emissions four times a year through ground surveys, the measurements are incomplete because many parts of landfills are too dangerous to walk through. You can't imagine what you can't imagine, lead author Daniel Cusworth from the University of Arizona tells Scientific American. For the study, researchers flew over 250 landfills in airplanes using infrared technology to detect the methane. At more than half the sites, they found huge methane plumes that may have been leaking for months or years. The average methane release from the sites was at least 1.4 times the amount reported to the EPA, sometimes nearly three times as much. Researchers say pinpointing the leaks this way will allow sites to mitigate them. A spike in meningitis. Health officials are warning of a sudden rise in severe meningococcal disease. The Centers for Disease Control says 422 cases of the bacterial infection that causes meningitis were reported last year, the most since 2014, and this year is on track to surge past that figure, with 143 cases seen in just the past 2 weeks. Meningitis, an inflammation of membranes on the brain and spinal cord, is transmitted through prolonged close contact, such as kissing or living with an infected person. Even with treatment, 10 to 15% of patients die, and survivors can suffer deafness or amputations. Usually babies, young adults, and the elderly are most susceptible, but this outbreak is disproportionately affecting adults between ages 30 and 60, as well as black people and those living with HIV. The government isn't recommending unusual precautions, CDC epidemiologist Lucy McNamara tells the Washington Post, but people should make sure they're up to date for meningococcal vaccinations. She also says to consult a doctor if meningitis symptoms occur, such as severe headache, fever, stiffness in the neck, or sensitivity to light. Finally, in the health and science section, Earth's rotation slowing. Climate change is now interfering with time itself, reports NBCNews.com. New study has found that the melting of polar ice is shifting the concentration of Earth's mass, leaving less on the poles, more around the equator, which is causing the planet to spin at a very slightly slower rate. Lead author Duncan Agnew from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, compares the effect to a figure skater spinning on ice. If she lowers her arms or stretches out her legs, she will slow down. This change is so significant that it is counteracting an opposite trend for various reasons, including long-term geological shifts and fluid movement within the Earth's inner core. The planet had been spinning faster in recent decades. This temporary acceleration has led timekeepers to consider subtracting a leap second from Coordinated Universal Time to keep it in sync with Earth's rotation. But the melting polar ice, the study found, has delayed the need to do that until at least the year 2029. Says Agnew, "It's kind of impressive. We've done something that measurably changes how fast the Earth rotates." Next, we have the business segment. Economy. Rising inflation ruins rate cut hopes. Inflation is heating back up, said Rachel Siegel in the Washington Post. Prices in March rose 3.5% year over year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported this week, jumping 0.4% month to month. Though still nowhere near where inflation peaked in 2022, the third straight month of rising prices seemed to signal a broader trend going in the wrong direction. That's a worrying development for the Federal Reserve, which came into 2024 optimistic about cutting interest rates by the spring. That now appears unlikely, and the market fell sharply after the inflation report's release. Housing and energy costs make up more than half of the month-to-month increase. "No question this is an economic setback," said Sam Goldfarb and Nick Timiraos in the Wall Street Journal. Fed officials have been willing to play down stronger than anticipated inflation readings in January and February as reflecting seasonal quirks. Now, however, there's little credible justification for cutting rates. The report's details were just as concerning as the headline numbers. A particular problem area was services outside of housing, which includes everything from car insurance to medical care. That category has been flagged by Fed officials as important because it can be sticky and closely linked to the strength of the labor market. The soft landing just got a lot bumpier. Also from the business segment, employment. Strong showing for labor as U.S. adds jobs. Last month's jobs report was as good as it gets, says Neil Irwin in Axios. Labor Department said last week that employers added 303,000 jobs in March, the strongest gain in 10 months. that robust job growth coincided with a healthy rate of wage growth, 0.3%, but nothing too crazy. That's because of a surge in the labor supply. About 469,000 people started working or looking for work in March, either due to immigration or just more people coming off the sidelines. Combination of job openings and labor force growth is pretty much an ideal situation for workers and employers. Some items from the bottom line column in the business section. The U.S. had 550 million dollar cities, or areas where the quote-unquote typical home value is $1 million or more. In February, according to Zillow, California has the most million-dollar cities with 210, which is more than the next five runner-up states combined. Florida lost 3 million-dollar cities from the year before. This from CNBC.com. In 2023, women held just 11.8% of roughly 15,000 C-suite roles at publicly traded U.S. companies, down from 12.2% the year before. It's the first time women have lost seats since 2005, the year S&P started measuring the data, from CNN.com. Instagram produced $32.4 billion in 2021, or 27% of Meta's total revenue. The app contributed $16.5 billion the first 6 months of 2022, according to documents released in the Federal Trade Commission's antitrust suit. Meta has never broken out Instagram's revenue during its earnings report. From Bloomberg. A new Morning Consult study found that 29% of employees say they preferred a hybrid arrangement compared with 23% who chose fully remote. That's flipped from 2022, when 29% preferred remote, 27% preferred hybrid. From Axios. The U.S. Postal Service said it is seeking to raise the price of a stamp by 5 cents to 73 cents, which would be the fourth bump since the start of 2023. If approved, stamp prices would be up 26% since August of 2021. And finally, from the bottom line column, Allbirds said this week it received a delisting warning from NASDAQ. Once hot sneaker seller had 6 months to trade at more than a dollar for at least 10 consecutive days, or risk being delisted. The share price had fallen more than 90% since its IPO in November of 2021. From the Business of Fashion. And finally, from the business segment, CHIPS Act. TSMC expands Arizona factory plans. The Biden administration is awarding Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company $6.6 billion to produce its most advanced semiconductors in Arizona, said Christine Mui in Politico. In addition to the federal grant, TSMC this week pledged to put up more than $65 billion on a third leading-edge chip factory, in addition to two already underway in Phoenix. Despite earlier delays, the first plant now may be ready to start running in 2025, ahead of schedule. Commerce Department this week also awarded Samsung a $6.6 billion grant to expand its chip output in Central Texas. Next, we'll turn the page to the Making Money segment. Life Paths, Choosing Trade School Over College. Gen Z isn't afraid to get its hands dirty, said Taiping Chen in the Wall Street Journal. Enrollment in vocational training programs rose 16% last year, even as community colleges and four-year institutions struggle to fill their classes. It's not a coincidence. Rising pay and new technologies in fields from welding to machine tooling are giving trade professions a facelift. Demand for skilled workers as an older generation retires is soaring, bringing wages along with it. Median pay for new construction hires, $48,089, outpaced new hires in accounting or IT, $39,520, last year for the fourth straight year. In Pennsylvania, new plumbers who might have made $35,000 5 years ago now get close to $60,000. Some in Gen Z said they're drawing to the skilled trades because of their entrepreneurial potential. College is still worth it, said Emily Peck in Axios. According to New York Fed, recent college grads last year working full-time earned $24,000 more per year than 22 to 27-year-olds with only a high school degree. Believe it or not, that gap has widened over time. In 1990, it was the inflation-adjusted equivalent of $15,000. And the full value of a college education accrues over a worker's lifetime, because jobs that non-college-educated people get typically don't see much wage growth. Trade schools are not a panacea, said Brent Orrell and David Veldren in The Dispatch. Many credentials still don't deliver improved earnings or career prospects, especially for disadvantaged Black and Latino learners. Narrow specialties are also more vulnerable to shifts in technology or automation. That's why today especially, we need high-quality credential programs to complement, not replace, a college education to support well-rounded and resilient future workers. Still, perceptions about what's achievable without a degree are changing, said Jessica Blake in Inside Higher Ed. For the second year in a row, more people believed that a certification was enough to earn a, quote, good job, end quote, than the number who thought you must have a college degree, according to surveys from Edge Research. And the fear of taking on debt is holding potential college students back. Doesn't help that this year's college admission season is shaping up to be worse than during the pandemic, said Rose Horwich in The Atlantic. Delays and technical glitches in the new federal student aid forms have left about 2 million families in bureaucratic purgatory less than a month before the May 1st enrollment deadline. For many, this fiasco may have been the last straw. According to the National College Attainment Network, 31% fewer high school seniors have applied for financial aid this year. That's 2.6 million students, including 600,000 entering college freshmen. Many of those could end up missing from the class of 2028. Also from the Making Money segment, the jumbo-sized microcaps. The Russell 2000 isn't all small stocks, said Charlie Grant in the Wall Street Journal. Two largest stocks in the small cap index, Super Microcomputer and MicroStrategy, have leapt to a combined market value of $84 billion, with $57 billion added this year alone. That's well beyond the index's typical holdings, which have a median market value of $900 million. Both micro firms are decades-old companies that have suddenly found themselves in the limelight. Supermicro makes servers that power AI capabilities, while MicroStrategy, a software firm, has benefited from the surging value of its crypto holdings. The company's time in the Russell 2000 will likely end in June when the index undergoes its annual rebalancing, which means the removal of companies with market values larger than $7.6 billion. Investing in SpaceX, Stripe, and OpenAI. A new fund allows regular investors to buy into privately held tech firms like SpaceX and OpenAI, said Aaron Griffith in the New York Times. Securities and Exchange Commission restricts startup investing to only so-called accredited investors with a net worth of $1 million or an annual income of $200,000. The reason? It's risky, and private companies can be difficult to assess because they're not required to share information about their operations. But a new publicly traded fund, Destiny Tech 100, holds shares of 23 of the biggest private tech companies, including Stripe, SpaceX, OpenAI, and Epic Games. Individuals can buy into the fund and see returns distributed to shareholders as a dividend once companies it is holding sell or go public. Finally, from making money, planning for the end, maybe later. Fewer Americans are writing wills, said Daniel DeVise in USA Today. Estate planners saw a spike in wills and trust during the pandemic, but since then, attention has moved on. Only 32% of adults reported having a will in 2024, down from 34% in 2023, according to Caring.com, a senior care platform. Among adults over 55, just 43% have a will, down from 48% in 2020. The percentage of over 70 households with wills or trusts have been in steady decline for years, despite the warning from financial planners about the importance of an estate plan. Without one, the local courts take over, but the biggest reason given to Caring.com for not having a will, procrastination. Our next segment from The Week magazine, Talking Points. First, documents case. Smith challenges Canon. Jack Smith has had enough, said Harry Littman in the Los Angeles Times, in response to a quote-unquote bizarre recent delaying tactic by federal judge Eileen Cannon. The special counsel pushed back hard last week in a blistering legal filing that raised the possibility he will ask the Trump appointee to be removed from the case for bias. The irate Smith objected to Cannon's recent order indicating that she may allow Trump to argue that his theft of classified intelligence agency documents was protected by the Presidential Records Act. The judge's legal premise is wrong, Smith wrote. Trump has been charged with violating the Espionage Act and with obstruction, while the PRA is limited to purely personal records. Smith requested that Cannon promptly reveal whether she would allow Trump's bogus defense at the trial so that the government could file an appeal with the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and seek to have her removed. Cannon is playing a very cagey game, said Jose Paglieri in the Daily Beast. In response to Smith's challenge, she refused to take the bait. Rather than opening the door to an appeal, she again kicked the can down the road, saying Smith's demand for a decision on Trump's personal record claim was unprecedented and unjust. If she waits to rule on Trump's defense until after the trial begins, it will likely be too late for the prosecution to appeal. If a Florida jury buys Trump's defense, prosecutors can't appeal either. Cannon keeps feeding the narrative that she's in Trump's pocket with favorable rulings, said University of Texas law professor Lee Kavrosky in New York magazine. Trump further raises suspicion by lavishly praising her. Is he dangling a promotion over her head? Cannon is very smart, very strong, and loves our company, Trump has said. Smith's case against Trump appears to be quite strong, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. The indictment lays out real crimes, including Trump's effort to hide the intelligence agency documents from the FBI. Still, Smith is taking a huge risk by confronting Cannon in such a quote-unquote dyspeptic way. He even took pains to remind her that the appeals court has already reversed her erroneous rulings twice. Cannon's response made it clear that she feels she has been insulted. If this case ever does go to trial in Cannon's Florida courtroom, the Washington-based prosecutor will be playing an away game before an offended judge appointed by the defendant. some items from the noted column and talking points. The doctor who wrote a medical report released by Donald Trump's campaign, attesting to his, quote, excellent health, end quote, with, quote unquote, exceptional cognitive ability, is a longtime member of Trump's golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. The doctor, osteopath Bruce Aronwald, declined to answer questions about his report, which consisted only of three short paragraphs with no numerical data or other specifics, from the Washington Post. An extremely active Atlantic hurricane season lies ahead starting June 1st, due in part to abnormally warm sea surface temperatures, say forecasters at Colorado State University. They predict 5 major hurricanes, 11 total hurricanes, and 23 named storms, compared with 7 total hurricanes and 14 named storms in an average season. From Reuters. Americans spend more than $100 billion on lotteries in 45 states and the District of Columbia last year, all that combined would make U.S. lotteries the country's 9th most profitable company. The poorest 1% of households spent an average of $600 a year on lotteries, a share of their income 30 times greater than that spent by the richest households. From The Economist. Only 70% of mail intended to be delivered by the U.S. Postal Service within 3 to 5 days arrived on time last year, an 11% drop from 2022. A $40 billion overhaul of the system ordered by Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has caused widespread disruptions. State and federal officials are voicing concerns about the possible impact on mail-in ballots in the 2024 election. From NBCNews.com. Next, the People segment. Apatow's comedy awakening. Judd Apatow no longer thinks that comedy can change hearts and minds, said Jesse David Fox in New York Magazine. Back in 2004, the writer and director of The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up was certain that Daily Show host Jon Stewart's acerbic commentary on the Iraq War would doom President George W. Bush's 2004 re-election bid. John was laying out some of the facts so clearly that there was no way Bush was going to get reelected, because the comedy was really vicious and accurate and right on the money, said Apatow, 56. Then he won the election. At that moment, I went, oh, it will never change it. He credits comedian Samantha Bee with setting him right on the limits of political humor. The purpose is to say to people who are like-minded, you're not crazy for feeling the way you feel. I don't think there are hardcore Republicans watching a new Jon Stewart bit going, now I get it. But Apatow is still searching for comedy everywhere, even in his doses of Ozempic. My goal was to outrun Ozempic, prove that you can gain weight on this thing, he says. I was almost offended at the idea that a drug could make me lose weight. My low self-esteem, which is sedated by food, cannot be stopped by your silly injection. Besides, he jokes, it doesn't work at all. I look terrible. Carmichael's radical exposure. Gerard Carmichael knows he's taking a huge risk, said David Holmes and Esquire. The comedian has followed his 2022 Emmy-winning HBO special, Rathaniel, with a documentary series, Gerard Carmichael Reality Show. Cameras trail Carmichael as he interacts with family, friends, and romantic partners. He was barred from the editing room so he couldn't cut out bits that made him look bad. The result is a radically honest depiction of the gay stand-up who only came out publicly in Rathaniel. He still faces backlash from his religious parents. My mom is a soldier for the Lord, said Carmichael, 37. She watched the trailer. She saw herself trying to pray the gay away. She's like, I hope this saves some souls. The dramatic makes for good TV, but a really difficult relationship, he admits. His parents' refusal to acknowledge his sexuality pushed him to up the ante with a docuseries. It's testing the limits of their cognitive dissonance, he explains. I'm still a kid just crying for attention. I'm just begging for attention. And for Carmichael, fully accepting himself remains difficult. I still think saying you're gay is saying something's wrong with you, he says. As long as it's a punchline, it's going to be scary for somebody. It's scary for me. Why, Hall embraced the monster movie. Rebecca Hall regrets being a movie snob, said Thessaly LaForce in the New York Times, best known for artsy films like Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona, 2008, and Christine, 2016. The British actress overthought every move when she was starting out, once scolding her agent for sending her to auditions for big-budget films. I wrote a letter at the time saying, I want to do interesting independent films. I'm not a conventional movie star. And how dare you, says Hall, daughter of Royal Shakespeare and Company founder Sir Peter Hall. I mean, I was probably nicer than that, but the gist of it was, I wish for you to conceive of me as something other than what you're conceiving me. But now she's starring in a genuine blockbuster, Godzilla vs. King Kong, The New Empire. 41-year-old sees these early decisions differently. By turning down big movies, Hall missed opportunities in small, character-driven ones, too. As cool and righteous as it sounds, I think it was an error, she admits. The more of these big jobs that I would have done in my 20s, the more access I would have had to other work. There was also incredibly arrogant to assume that all these films were unworthy. Appearing in big crowd pleasers gives her the financial freedom to make smaller films, but she adds, it's not just a cynical move. There's also a huge amount of fun in it. And from the Poll Watch column, 7% of Americans currently own an electric vehicle, up from 4% last year. 44% say they are currently considering buying one or might consider it in the future, from Gallup. And in states where abortion is prohibited, 21% of women of reproductive age say they know someone who has faced difficulties in getting an abortion since Roe was overturned. 74% of women say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, from KFF. And let's wrap up with some wit and wisdom. Good artists copy, great artists steal. Pablo Picasso quoted in the Daily Express from the UK. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. George Orwell, quoted in the Washington Post. The experience of a trembling, wobbling motion of everything we rely on for our sense of direction and reality is among the most common and most vivid experiences of totalitarian rule. Hannah Arendt, quoted in Lithub. Ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather must recognize that it is he who is asked. Viktor Frankl, quoted in Medium.com. A terrorist is a man with a small gun. A statesman is a man with a large gun. Irish writer Brendan Behan, quoted in NB Media Co-op from Canada. If you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. Margaret Thatcher, quoted in Yahoo News. And finally, don't ask the barber whether you need a haircut. Warren Buffett, quoted in the Financial Times. And that's all we have time for today. I've been reading from the April 19th installment of The Week magazine. We thank you for listening. So long until next time.